Okay, so we are in this extended journey through the Bible. One of the things you're going to notice is that we don't go at the same pace for all the parts of the Bible, which is sort of like frustrating at some moments, but maybe helpful so we can actually get through the Bible. So we're in the middle of the Old Testament, and we're in the books of Joshua and Judges today. So we spent a number of weeks talking about the Pentateuch, which is the first five books of the Bible, and today this story continues, and so that's where we are. Just so I know, for reference, how many of you have read the books of Joshua and Judges? Anybody in here read them? Okay. You certainly have heard parts of the stories if you've been in church, or you've anyone know Samson, story of Samson? Okay, so that's in Judges. So these are some very interesting and colorful books, and we could spend, again, a long time in these books, because there's a lot to talk about in them. But I want to keep the trajectory of the story moving, so that's why we're going to move through these in just 1 week here. And then next week, John Trammell, who's not here today, is going to be teaching on the book of Ruth, and he's been working on that, which is a wonderful book. And I'm envious that I gave that to him to teach, because I really love that book a lot. And then if my wife was here, she'd tell you that's her favorite book, and she's read it like 150 times or something like that. Like every time she goes to read the Bible and she doesn't know what to read, she reads Ruth. So anyway. Okay, well, so let's look at this here. I'm on this whole story page here. The way that Joshua is presented, or let me just back up and say that the story ends in the end of Deuteronomy with Moses dying. He goes up on the mountain. He looks over into the promised land. He doesn't get to go in himself, but he gets to see it, which has been the whole dream of his life. And then his successor, Joshua, a young buck who's been trained under Moses, takes over. And the beginning of the book starts with God affirming it many times and saying, be courageous, be strong, because you know Moses had some sort of big shoes to fill, so it's pretty tough to follow up his role. But he takes over, and the text presents him as almost like a Moses 2.0. Like he does a lot of the same things that Moses does, and he is leading people into the land. So it begins with this whole section of like a renewal of the covenant, where Joshua goes to the people like Moses did, and he says, here's the terms of the covenant. Remember, this is what God said to do. Are you going to obey? And the people say, we're going to obey. And then he sends out spies into the land. Do you remember how Moses did that 40 years earlier, sent spies into the land? This time it goes well, though. The spies are come back, and they have a different report. They then cross through the Jordan. So I'm going to draw my terrible map again here. This is the Mediterranean here. This is the Nile River, Egypt. This is the Red Sea here, the Sinai Peninsula. And this is, that's nothing, sorry. This is the land of Israel here. So when they came out of Egypt, they went through these lakes called the Bitter Lakes, which are also called the Sea of Reeds, the Red Sea. They went through here, went down into the Sinai area, and they circled around here for a long time. Up here is the Sea of Galilee, the River Jordan, and the Dead Sea here. Jerusalem's here for reference. So then they came around here, and they came up here, and this is where they were camped out, right here for a while, getting ready to come into the land, because this is really the heart of the land is right here, where they were coming. So they're there, and then they have this same sort of miraculous experience of going through the water again. God holds Jordan is at flood stage. It's not a very big river, actually, but it's at flood stage. It's really difficult to get across that river, so God holds up the water so that they can go across on dry ground again, which sounds just like what Moses did, right? So Moses, again, 2.0. They cross over. Then as they're in the land there, they recognize that for some reason or another, they haven't been circumcising the men. And they're not part of the covenant community. And so before they could really ratify and move into being the covenant people, they had to be circumcised. So there's this whole passage about the men all being circumcised, which apparently hadn't done for a while. Interesting random stuff that you find in scriptures. Then they celebrate the Passover, because only circumcised people can celebrate the Passover. It's for the community of Israel. So then they're moving into the land. And then there's this really interesting passage, which I want to read together and I want to talk about for a moment with you. So it's on here, on this page here. Do you all have the sheets of paper? Everyone have one? Okay, there's a few extras there if you need them. I'm going to ask Nathan, would you read for us Joshua 5, 13 through 15?
Sure.
And then listen, and I want you to comment on what you hear in this text, okay?
Once when Joshua was by Jericho, he looked up and saw a man standing before him with a drawn sword in his hand. Joshua went to him and said to him, "Are you one of us or one of our adversaries?" He replied, "Neither, but as commander of the army of the Lord I have now come." And Joshua fell on his face to the earth and worshipped, and he said to him, "What do you command your servant, my lord?" The commander of the army of the Lord said to Joshua, "Remove the sandals from your feet, for the place where you stand is holy." And Joshua did so.
All right. The word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Okay. So what do you notice in this passage here? Just make some observations, comments, could be obvious things. What stands out to you? Yeah.
He recognizes he's an angel.
Okay. So he sees there's an angel he engages with. Okay. All right. And the angel is specifically... You're right. Exactly. Okay. That's great. What else do you notice here? Okay. What's the significance of that? Okay, so sandals, holy ground. Do you remember we talked... This is just an echo back of Moses, right? Moses is at the burning bush, and what happens? He's like, take off your shoes. So here, Moses has his own burning... Joshua has his own burning bush experience here. He encounters the presence of God in the form of God's angel. So there's the sandals and the holy ground. What else...
The angels were packing.
Yes, these are not like tender little infant winged angels. These are guys who like swords. They're fighters. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Immediate obedience.
Say more about what you mean by that.
Well, when he was asked to do it, he didn't think twice. He just did it and removed his sandals.
Okay. Okay. So Joshua responds with Joshua. I should put faith here. Yeah. Okay, that's good. What do you think of Joshua's question? What do you notice about that? Anybody? Go ahead, John.
I think there are several stories where it's important whether you can identify you're part of the same tribe or not.
Huh.
Isn't that the origin of the shibboleth?
Yes.
But I forget where that is.
That's later on in Joshua or Judges. I think it's in Judges, actually. I don't know. Yeah. There's a local dialect problem of and so you say the certain word and you know which tribe you're part of based on how you say it. So, but you're saying in the context of this, he's trying to identify, are you with us or are you against us? Like, are you part of our people or who are you, right? So this is an interesting question though. Like, what is he after here? Do you have any thoughts on that? Like,
would he admit he was against them if he was?
That's kind of a funny thing, right? Yeah, like the enemies usually do that, right? Yeah.
Well, it also harkens to me to the story in the New Testament when the emperor, supposedly, Quirinius, asked for a census, which would identify everybody as citizens or not.
Yeah. Yeah, so this is something common that rulers do is they determine who are their people. Yeah, were you going to say Elizabeth? Go ahead. Yeah, at a basic level, like, am I going to have to fight you, right? Okay, so...
I think it's also interesting that all through the Bible, it's almost all encounters with God or a heavenly being, is humans initially, their reaction is not, this is God. Hmm. I mean, it's never obvious to them.
Yeah.
Or many times it's not, even all the way through the New Testament, even when Jesus appeared after the resurrection.
Yeah. So whenever God shows up, if God doesn't cloak his glory in some sort of, like, protective barrier to humanity, it would overwhelm us, as we talked about last week with the holiness. So God shows up sort of in disguise in many cases and in his presence. Yeah, Elizabeth?
The part in the Bible says we entertain angels unawares.
Yes, that's right.
So he's not always obvious, but after a while, maybe even a year later, you might go, ooh, that was a God moment.
Right, right. Okay. All right, so here's something that I think is fascinating in this passage. This man identifies himself as the commander of the army of the Lord. And Joshua's asking him, which side are you on? His answer is interesting. Neither. Like, I'm not on your side, and I'm not on those people's side. Like, I have my... Really, the question is, whose side are you on? Like, that's what he's asking Joshua. Like, where are you? I know who I am. I'm with the Lord, and I think that's really helpful as a setup for this passage, because the passage then moves into how the Israelites are going to be pushing out the people in the land, which is very controversial stuff we're going to talk about in a moment here. And I think it's important for us as an identifier to go that God didn't just nakedly identify himself with his people in a way that like justified their violence or all their tendencies. Like, God has his own agenda, and Israel is to come and join his agenda, not the other way around. Because a lot of times you think of these violent stories as, like, in ancient Near Eastern culture, is like everybody's justifying what they're doing with violence in the name of their God. And this story is counteracting that. Do you get that? Like, whose side are you on? Are you, you'd assume that the angel would say, I'm on your side, for sure. Let's go beat him up, you know? But the angel's like, neither. I'm not taking, this is not my thing here. Whose side are you on? You're like, are you with us, you know? Like, so do you see what I'm saying with that? Does that make sense? Okay, all right. So then the battles take place. Y'all probably heard the Battle of Jericho. There's that famous song. Joshua fit the Battle of Jericho. They go around this 7 times and the walls fall down. That's also where Rahab is, the prostitute is. And there's all sorts of fascinating stories in this part here. So then that's the first story. That goes really well. They don't do anything except for go around the city a number of times and then God knocks the walls down. All taken care of. The next story is not so great. So God had said, when those walls get knocked down, don't take any of this for your personal property. This is not for your plunder. Like, you don't get to have all the stuff. Like, I'm not just enriching you for the sake of, like, your own self. These are to be devoted to God. Well, a guy named Achan, or I grew up hearing it, Achan, but in Hebrew it would be more like Achan, took a bunch of stuff himself. Ends up that, like, he's breaking this sort of covenantal structure. God then punishes Israel because they've not doing this right. So they try to go up and take the next city on their own power. Things go really poorly. Then they're trying to figure out what went wrong, and they realize this guy has done this wrong thing, and a very extreme thing happens where they actually stone him and his whole family, which is pretty rigorous, pretty extreme. And then the next stories are about this guy's name, the Jebusites. The Jebusites are the guys that are up by Jerusalem. And then there's a story about the Gibeonites, and the Gibeonites are these guys that trick Israel into thinking that they're like really distant enemy or distant peoples, and they make a treaty with Israel so that Israel doesn't come in and like take them over, and God honors that treaty, interestingly enough. And then all the other Canaanite city-states are then little by little overcome and pushed out and destroyed. When you read through Joshua, you get this sense that the land that has been promised to Israel is finally theirs now. But there's this, for us as modern readers, we are like, is this like good? Like, there's a lot of violence. There's people groups that are being like, you know, city states and people groups that are being destroyed. And so there's this question, which I would guess that some of you have probably wrestled with before. Like, how do we understand the violence in the book of Joshua? What do we do with it? And so I'm curious sort of what your thoughts are on that. Have you encountered this question? Is this something that has bothered you? I see some heads nodding here. What do you think about it? Any thoughts? Everyone's scared to say what they think on this. Yeah. Go ahead, Lynn. You haven't said something yet?
That many parts of the Bible are really hard to understand why God would call us to do something that seems on the face of it wrong to us. But I think that's because we're not on his side, so we don't really all the time, we don't really understand, maybe someday we will, what his agenda is. And his agenda, really, through the Bible, seems to encompass a whole bunch of things that we might really question and almost fight against and rebel against and refuse to do.
So what I hear you saying really well is we shouldn't presume that we understand what God is up to all the time. And in that, I put here mystery and there's like a humility that goes with that to go, okay, that we'll see where the Lord is taking this whole thing.
Yeah.
Okay, I like where you're going with that.
You know, homosexuality, really tough one for all of us probably take the words of the Bible and continue to live that out in as loving way as we can in the face of all sorts of opposition.
Yeah.
And just trust that God knows what he's doing.
Right. So there are places like this, and in our cultural time and moment, sexual ethics happen to be one of them, which is like, why would God say this thing or not that? So that's a place.
We wish that, we'd all just get along.
Right, right. Right. So there's as God's people, there's a core humility that we have a posture of like submitting to what God says, even sometimes when we don't quite understand it. In a similar way, can I just say, echoing back to the story of Abraham with Isaac, like what in the world? Like God says, sacrifice your son. Like what? That seems like the most abominable thing to do, right? But God has something he's doing in that. That is really important, and he prevents it from happening at the end. So, yeah, Elizabeth, you're insisting. Yeah.
Mine is like to love and not judge.
Okay.
God take care of it. Like that, as far as homosexuality, transgender. friends all over the place.
Yeah.
And God asked me to love them, to show them love, His love. To take care of the rest, to take care of the rest. That's not for me to do. It's not my job to fix people. My job is to represent Him to the best of my ability. And everyone needs a hug.
Yeah. So one of the things that I hear you saying, kind of a principle underneath it, is not too different to what you're saying, which is let God be God, and we're His people, and we're a place of obedience. Tom, and then we'll go here to John.
I mean, I think that in terms of the violence and the kind of the taking the land, I think we've all probably been indoctrinated with, you know, Hagensee's just war concept. So the concept of them taking the land is not probably that much a struggle for me.
Huh.
And it looks like you're going to get there later. It's the sometimes the total destruction of all women, children.
Uh-huh.
That part is, I think, the harder piece.
Yeah.
It's kind of one thing to take the land. It's another thing to annihilate the people who are there.
Right, right.
And so that's the one that's probably...
That's the more troubling aspect of this.
One, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, John. And
I'm really curious, and I don't have any opinion on it. I'm curious about your opinion, about the apparent militarization of the people of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
Since they were freed from slavery in Egypt, they wandered in the Sinai and elsewhere for 40 years, basically living on manna and surviving.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden, they're waging war.
Right.
And how did that happen? You know, did they have, like, people making swords the whole time they were in the desert? Did they acquire a sword suddenly? Where did they get the war, bronze or whatever, to make the swords?
Yeah.
Was that part of God's plan, is that they were suddenly turned into an army?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it is a curious thing, and it seems to be a fairly... you shouldn't imagine a sophisticated military operation here, because you know, stories later on in Samuel about the fact that the Philistines made sure that there was no iron workers or coppersmiths or whatever in Israel, and so they had to go down to the Philistines to get a sword because they didn't have any. So I think we should say this is pretty basic. Maybe they're using sticks and rocks and whoever, who knows what else. They got some swords from somewhere. But it doesn't appear to be sophisticated warfare, that's for sure. Yeah. Okay, Matt back there, and then Nathan here, and then I want to offer some thoughts too.
This raised a lot of questions for me about who God is, what is His character, is this something that we should be learning from our example of how to be like Christ.
Mm-hmm. Yes, go out and destroy. That's the message this morning here. No, I hear your question. But people do use these passages to justify all kinds of violence, right? There have been historical examples of people doing that. So your question is actually spot on. Now, I think you're going to hear very clearly from me, this is not what we're saying here. But how do we get from there, from A to Z, right, is the kind of the question here. Nathan, go ahead.
So I guess it seems to me like there's two issues. One is treating a whole bunch of people the same because of the sins of their leader or something like this. So even if the leaders of this people were bad or cruel or something, why would you kill all the women and children? So there's kind of that issue. And then there's also the issue of just the violence of it and the destruction of it. And so I think on the issue of treating people as part of their group instead of just as individuals, we have a lot of work to do in realizing how people in, very communal societies that aren't really individualistic, how they think of themselves and how they live and just who they are, that it would actually make a lot of sense to... you wouldn't even think of yourself in a lot of ways as an individual. You'd think of yourself as, of course it makes sense that whatever happens to my group is what also should happen to me. And, I got some insights into that, just living some in Africa, where cultures are more like that. And so I think we have a lot of work to do just to kind of get out of our culture and realize what actually makes sense in terms of justice in less individualistic cultures. But then there's also still the issue of all this violence and And yeah, I'm not entirely sure how to deal with that, but I do know that, because I know that like God does like punish people or kill people for different things, but then it's kind of a different issue, and it's just, and it makes sense in a lot of cases. It like reduces the harm or the evil that would have happened if they had continued. It puts a limit on it, and so it's a little less clear to me what we as God's agents, though, or like what
yes.
kind of rules do we have to follow? Like,
yes.
are we ever allowed to do that?
Yes.
Or not?
Those are both really helpful comments. I want to like elaborate on them, because the first comment about the collective identity versus individual identity, this is something that I've put a lot of thought and research into the last year or two here, because part of it came from a book that I was reading that traced the idea of the idea of a person or an individual understood. This is really a fairly recent phenomenon, actually. It's within the Christian era that this happened. People thought in terms of collective identities, and it was really the early church fathers combining with Greek thought that combined this idea of what is a person that we think of today. So when you read ancient documents, you have to read them through the lenses of the people of the time and how they thought. And to be careful also to make too many assumptions about what we think of as the great priority of the individual today. That's like our own pole that we move to, but I think there's something to be thought about that. So that's like a whole side topic, but I think it's good that you brought that up. The other issue that I think you're highlighting really well is there's a difference between God striking someone down with lightning, so to speak, and God telling me to go take a sword and strike someone down, right? And I think that we might be uncomfortable with both, but you're probably much more uncomfortable with God telling me to strike you down with a sword, right? That's a little more troubling. And I think that's what people usually have a problem with, as Tom was saying, when God says to these people, go and basically exterminate this city-state or whatever like that. Okay, so I think that's the challenge here. Elizabeth, go ahead.
Our Lord and Savior is the Alpha and the Omega. He's seen the beginning to the end.
Yeah.
So he knows the whole picture. We don't. We just see snippets.
Yeah.
So that's why they're doing wise obedience. And that angel was a general.
Uh-huh.
That was the top of the line, general angel.
Yeah.
To meet him.
Yeah.
So he had the power and authority to say what God told him to say.
Right.
And then it was up to Joshua to acknowledge that authority. Bow down and submit.
Yeah.
And acquiesce.
Yeah. So you're back to the principle here again of the humility under God's leadership there. Okay. So I want to look at this question with a couple of responses. I wrote down some bullet points here. Some people read these passages in the Old Testament, and you'll read someone like Christopher Hitchens, who's like a pretty aggressive, he's dead now, but a fairly aggressive atheist, and he'll say, God is a monster. When you read these passages, what you have is a genocidal monster. How could you ever worship this God? Kind of the question that Matt was asking, like about God's character. So he takes them, and he reads everything through them, right? Another set of people will say, actually, like some scholars will go, this didn't actually happen. Like, this was just like ancient Near Eastern propaganda. This is, you know, big talking about, like, you know, we're going to, sort of like what Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump were doing a year ago. They seem to be talking better now. But a year ago, they were like, we will destroy you off the face of the planet, you know, like, we're going to, you know, completely melt down your whatever. And the third option would be that God didn't actually sanction the violence, that Israel merely claimed that they were divinely justified to the right to destroy other nations. Other people say that. And sometimes Christians read this, and I would say Christians who maybe don't have a super high view of Scripture, they'll go, yeah, that's just those Old Testament guys. They wrote that stuff. We know better in Jesus, and so we just kind of discard this stuff. We don't listen to it. It's not really important to us as well right now. Okay? Then there's a whole other group of people who are saying, no, this has happened, but it was God's righteous judgment for Canaanite sin. For example, there's a few very small passages that allude to perhaps some pretty awful practices of these people. They sacrifice their children, that they have these weird, bestiality and weird sexual things they're doing. And so that God decides that they're like, they've gone past the edge, and so he is destroying them. So some people read it that way, and then they say that with some measure of discomfort that God, because as Elizabeth was saying, God was the general in charge of this, that he was the one responsible for this sort of thing. So that's another option. And then there's another option that I have come across recently in this book that I was reading this week, which I didn't even get to finish, called The Lost World of the Israelite Conquest. And this guy, John Walton, and his son, John Walton has done a lot of really interesting research about ancient Near Eastern civilization. Like, he has a a true expert in that and has some excellent stuff on Genesis and that I've referred to already in this sequence that we've been teaching here. But he says this. One possibility he says is this is more like eminent domain. Are you guys familiar with eminent domain? So like if they're going to put a freeway through like a certain neighborhood, the government comes in and goes, sorry, we're taking your house. Like you don't get real choice in this and we're going to put the freeway right here. So tough luck. And the way that this is thought of is that Yahweh owns, the God of Israel, he owns not just Israel, but he owns the land, everything. But particularly he has had a claim on this land to build a kind of temple. Not like just the temple in Jerusalem, but like that the land itself is like the ground of a kind of temple for himself. And he sees this language here in the passages here. And the idea is then that the squatters need to be driven out. Like these other people have been on the land, but it's not really their land. You know, it's like you just put a tent there. It's actually yours. So, and then he reads this interestingly as the intention of this is to bring order to a place of chaos or non-order. He reads this as just like in Genesis, when the first creation happened, there was chaotic waters and God, Spirit of God hovered over the waters and he brought order out of chaos. That we talked about that back in the beginning of this. And this is not to be read, interestingly, he says, this is not to be read as punishment for sin, which he says entails culpability for covenantal commitments. Like he says, these Canaanite peoples didn't have the Torah. They didn't know that some of the practices they were doing were wrong. They just, like, they were not culpable in that same sort of way. And then he notes that, at least in the initial stage, it is really God that does the fighting. Like it's, and oftentimes there's sort of an opportunity for the people to move out. Like here, the whole idea is that God's glory has gone before him. What he did to Egypt has been known to these nations. It's well broadcast. They're coming in here, and so the people have the opportunity to get out, and the choice is whether they're going to do that or not. And then the goal of this is for the land to be made holy such that God can dwell within it. And remember the opposite of that was what we heard last week where the scriptures say, like, if you maintain this level of impurity, the land which is holy cannot contain you. It will vomit you out. That's the language of the Old Testament. In a sense, the land is vomiting these people out before them. And that's the idea here. Now, this still doesn't quite get to... I find this interesting. I find it...
It doesn't explain the genocide part.
It doesn't quite still get to the genocide part. Right, yeah. So, it does frame it slightly differently, though. So, the Hebrew word that is often used for this utterly destroyed, totally destroyed, devote to destruction is this word harem, which is... he argues, and I've seen other scholars argue, is commonly mistranslated. And if you look at Hebrew, Hebrew is a complicated language because it has a very small vocabulary, and one word can mean any number of different things, like 20 different... there's a word called Aleph in Hebrew, and it means 1,000, and it means tribe, and it means like four or five other different things. And you're like, well, which one is it? And it depends on the context of that.
Worst class ever.
Hebrew was?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Hebrew is tough. Hebrew's tough, yeah. So anyway, here's what they say here. They say that harem should be translated the removal of something from human use. So harem can imply destruction, but it often does not. And he uses the examples of how there are certain places where things are devoted to destruction, but they literally end up in the hands of the Levites. And like the Levites are like using them for like God's things, not for like their own things. So then he says, he follows a sequence here of what he says happens. He says, the necessity of a town's military defeat is determined. They haven't left. The squatters are still there. They're doing their own thing, right? The town is then attacked by the army. Defenders are defeated. So there's actual real battles. People are killed. But the battle is not the consequence of harem. Harem happens after the battle is over is the point here. The site is declared harem, is in other words, forbidden from human use. This is to be a depopulated place. Then the violators of the ban, actual or hypothetical, are punished. And so this is where you do have exterminations of peoples who refuse to leave, who first refuse to do what has been said to be done. So how does this feel to you? Is it helpful at all? Does it feel like, nah, it doesn't really resolve any of the problems I had at all of that? Elizabeth, and then any other comments?
It does for me. Because the previous prime minister of Israel was my personal friend for many years, Ariel Sharon. And when I spoke, he came, he flew from Israel 3 days after the death of his son. He because in Israel, all children have to go for 2 years in the army, regardless, even Prime Minister's son. His Prime Minister's son was a sniper in the Israeli army, and he died 3 days previous to the Prime Minister coming and keeping his word to unite this America and speaking before Congress on homelessness and poverty in America and how it affects Israel. So he asked me, I was homeless at the time in Washington, D.C., almost died in the snow. He knew this, and he asked me to personally speak about it. So he gave up his time before Congress, and he said, this is my friend, listen, here's her story. And then I shared, you know, and I say all that to say this. When the gentleman here, Nathan, was talking about the global, they think global. They don't think like individualists like America is taught to raise to be. I was raised abroad, so I think globally too. So therein lies the answer to my crux, I guess, because I think of all, not just me, and not just, I'm proud to be American, don't get that wrong, but at the same time, I think of others, because I know that my footprint affects everybody.
Thank you. Yeah. Other people have thoughts on this as well. John?
Well, it just seems like there are lots of ancient concepts that can't be applied now.
Yeah.
Like in Hera.
Yeah.
Like removing your sandals, this is holy ground.
Right.
Like all of the, you know, those rules,
the
things that are called abominations
in
Deuteronomy. It's like, okay, what do we do with that?
Yeah.
How do we apply them to present thinking, if at all?
Right.
You just put it aside as, you know, antiquated thinking.
Yeah, yeah, okay. So this is a question of interpretation, which is different than understanding what happened, right? Understanding what happened is one thing, and then interpreting what does that mean to us today is a very different thing. And I think we want to make sure we're clear on that, right? Go ahead, John.
I have two totally unrelated thoughts. One is, I think this is an interesting place where there is a lot of Christianity thinking, this is the Old Testament, they toss it away. And this would be one of the key cases in which they want to toss away. But boy, good thing Jesus came and changed everything. You know, not a really serious undertaking of the Old Testament. There's like a whole big swath of Christendom that treats the Old Testament that way.
Right.
Which I think it's just an interesting thing to know. Then a question, which is unrelated. Would the Canaanites be seen as the descendants of Esau?
No.
No.
Those would be the Edomites. Yeah.
Ishmael.
No, not Ishmael. No, they wouldn't be that either. Yeah.
Who were the Canaanites?
Canaanites were just other people groups. They were like Hittites, Akkadians, Phoenicians. They're people who came in and occupied that area there. But they weren't in any way directly related to the... Like we saw earlier in the story, there were some other characters that were important that became nations around. So Moab, Edom, Aram, a couple of these other groups, all related to Abraham's family in some way, but not actually these Canaanite groups.
So people who might look to these ancient conflicts as it relates to current world got their lineage wrong.
They got their lineage all wrong. This has nothing to do with Palestinians and Israelis. Mm-mm. I think that would be a really poor reading of this whole area here. Yeah, Hart?
Is it possible that we kind of overvalue life because we're looking at it from a New Testament perspective? I mean, if it's like Jews were the chosen people and everyone else has kind of just gone to the wind anyway, do their lives kind of matter that much, like, perspectively?
That's an interesting comment. So I don't even know how to respond to that. I think what I hear you saying is that if we draw firm lines of a covenant and say these are only God's people and the rest are kind of like, whatever, then they're discardable at some level. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Well, if it's like they can't be saved anyway because Jesus hasn't come and kind of included everyone in the world. It's just like Jews and everyone else is kind of...
I think that's an interesting idea. I think it's probably not quite like a reading of the Old Testament because you have Abraham's promise, and Abraham is that Abraham will be a blessing to the nations, and the nations will be a blessing to him, and in him all nations will be blessed. And so, even in the Old Testament, you see that there's this exchange of blessing between the identified covenant people and the neighbors surrounding them in some way or another. And that God's salvation is also included to be more broadly than that. God talks about how he has people in these other nations. And even there's like prophetic oracles sent to other nations around as well too. So I think we have to be careful not to draw the boundary too thick and tight around Israel being the only people being saved.
There's also provisions in the Mosaic law for people becoming part of the people of Israel.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, it's not a static concept. It's a dynamic community that has always included more than people who are just sort of ethnically Jewish in that sense. In fact, David's grandmother is, you're going to learn this next week, is a Moabitess. She's not actually, Ruth is not actually an Israelite. So that taints the sort of family tree of David's purity of being like the ultimate Jew, right? You know, and so Jesus has him in his line too. So yeah, anyway, Mark, go ahead.
God is capable of bringing good out of what appears to be evil. And one example of that to me as a foreign Englishman is the Revolutionary War in America. A lot of people were killed, a lot of suffering, but it produced a country which has been a tremendous force of good on the whole in the world.
So God can take what is dark and evil and broken that we cannot see good out of, this is kind of back to your comment, Lynn, and he can draw out something good that is mysterious to us that we could not have seen in some way or another. And this is the story again and again. It's the story of Joseph going into Egypt, right? Like this horrible thing. His brother gets sold and sent down. He's in prison for a number of years. And then he ends up saving all of Egypt through what he does. So yeah, that's the classic story. Tom.
I go back to, obviously the concept of Aaron for me is, intellectually makes sense, because if you look at just human nature, we have a tremendous capacity for syncretism. Mm-hmm. And Israel did all through that. So to the extent there's anything apart from God in any culture that they come in contact with, they tend to incorporate. Mm. So the concept of putting it out of human use, so you, almost for purity's sake, mm-hmm. makes total sense. But then when it comes to just the whole, genocide is the response to prevent that. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the part that still, I would think, internally struggle with. Mm-hmm. So, is this really God? And it seems like a... But then again, I guess if you compare genocide to if we're lost, it's the same God who condemns people who don't accept his grace. So it's...
Yeah.
So.
But again, the challenge is if that's in human hands, it feels different than if it's in God's hands, right? Yeah. Yeah. Lynn, go ahead. And then Matt. Sorry.
Back to also what I said before, that our agenda isn't necessarily his agenda. His agenda is so much his glory, I think, that it does twist our minds he uses these things that are seemingly evil or silly kings or whatever, ultimately for his glory. Whatever that, if it is showing the world, he's the God of Israel. And this is what happens maybe when you don't bend to the will of the God of Israel, or mm-hmm. whatever it was, or whatever it is today. Mm-hmm. I think that he uses so much of seemingly evil or silly things ultimately for his glory.
That's a confident.
So hard for us to see that.
That's a confident statement of faith at some level to say something like that, right? Which is like, I don't understand, but God is going to be glorified because we trust that he is in fact good in some way. Matt, go ahead.
This is pretty far for me. I see the idea of God using evil for seemingly evil stuff for good, but with eminent domain thing and with it's like God is acting to take the land, and then it's not because of the sin of the Canaanites, but it's just like, you happen to be living in the city and you're not part of Israel, and then you get attacked. I kind of have struggled with the morality of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this is not to say that they weren't sinners, by the way. It's just that what John Walton is trying to say is that it's not because of their more egregious sinners necessarily that God is doing this. That's all he's arguing in that. And again, I don't know that I identify fully with this theory. I would just put out a number of different ideas so we can see how people handle this, because I think it's interesting for us to wrestle with. John, and then Nathan, and then I'm going to do some final wrappings there.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm still totally perplexed by the whole thing.
Yeah.
But I wanted to respond to the Christopher Hitchens argument.
Yeah.
Which I find a common one, which is, God can't be moral if, mm-hmm. but Christopher Hitchens is by definition a materialist, i.e. everything randomly developed in New
right.
York. So if you take his idea to its logical conclusion, a genocide is no different from a snowfall. It's just nature working its way itself out.
Yeah.
So Christopher Hitchens and the ilk have no right to appeal to an external authority of morality.
Yes.
It's only by appealing to God can you say that God is doing the right thing.
Yes.
If you forget that there's any kind of external authority governing human nature, then he doesn't have any basis for
yeah.
No one has any basis for yeah. saying that genocide is any different from leaves falling from a tree.
Yeah. Exactly. So the whole moral basis of his argument is like built actually on.
I'm saying that God doesn't exist.
It's actually built
God
on the tree
exist.
Of Christian.
God doesn't exist because he didn't obey God's laws.
Yeah, his whole argument is built on the tree of Christian morality. Yeah. They just sever it off at a certain
exactly.
point, right? And that's why it doesn't hold for us. Okay, Nathan, and then on rep.
So it does seem to me that this idea brings out something important, which is that like God is like when you. Yeah, so God is trying to set up a people of God with certain laws that are going to define them. Like, he's setting up something so that will show the world this is what it means to be mm-hmm. people of God. This is what it looks like. Mm-hmm. And in order to do that, you need land. You need a space to mm-hmm. do that. That's dedicated to that, that isn't influenced by a lot of other evil practices and mm-hmm. laws. And so it does make some sense to me that that like the land itself is important. It's not just a matter of comparing like, well, these people are better than these ones. We're mm-hmm. It's like God isn't saying that Israel is good. They have a lot of work to do, but he's mm-hmm. trying to set up a space where that will be a place where his laws will be in effect and people will be following them. And Israel has a lot of work to do. Mm-hmm. And these other nations are doing practices or following laws that are bad. Anyway, so setting up a space, but I think like Matt, you're saying, it's not really just satisfying to say, like, oh, it has nothing to do with how good or bad the people were who were already there. I think there does have to be some. I mean, I would want to really look into, well, were they doing really bad things? Like, what were their laws that were worse than the laws that are going to be coming in and being mm-hmm. set up? And that, like, if they're killing their children and, you know, doing horrible things like that, that I would think that we do have to take some of that into consideration mm-hmm. as, you know, why God is seeing this as a justified thing to do.
Yeah, yeah. So I want to wrap this conversation. That's a good thoughts, by the way. I want to wrap this conversation, not putting a bow on it in any way, because I don't think there is a nice bow for it. I think it's really difficult stuff. I think as Christians, we wrestle with this because it's in our Bible. I think we have to. I don't agree with the people who just want to dismiss it out or who are doing like what John was saying a minute ago, that say like Old Testament, we don't really do that anymore now. We're just New Testament people or whatever, because it's just too simple. It actually doesn't work. It cuts off the whole story that makes sense. So I think that's a really bad way to go about it. What I do want to say is that the preeminent revelation of God is what we have in Jesus Christ. And what happened in Jesus Christ is that he died on a Roman cross, right? Like he, in a sense, absorbed into himself the violence of our world, the evil of our world. And I think you cannot actually read the Old Testament rightly if you don't read it through Jesus and the cross. And especially, Matt, what you were asking about earlier, and when we come to what we're doing as Christians, we follow the crucified and risen Savior. And so that is where we draw our whole picture. Like that's where we draw our whole picture of what it means to be human and what it means to be faithful from. Now that builds on a whole procedural story that included Israel having to have land, having to have the protections of the Torah to build a distinctive people so that God could reveal that he is one and not many, and so that we can reveal that God is pure and only and good, and that Jesus is the face of the Father. All those things we had to have in place in order to get to that place. And so I think we should not curse our own roots in that sense. So I want to encourage a very high view of reading the Old Testament, that we really wrestle with and grapple with it. But I also want to say that as we go to interpret it, that we interpret it through Jesus. I think it's really important for us to hear that. Does that make sense, what I'm saying? And there's good news in this, right? Like, if Jesus is the center of everything, then that's great news. So, all right, we're going to go ahead and stand up together and say a prayer, and then we'll move into to worship together.